by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Part number three of our three-part series, all about aquatics in Wyoming and projects and habitat. And Janet, back with John one more week, and it's been very informative. And I've heard from folks that they're a little more interested, I think, of the goings-on when it comes to things like the river, or, you know, even a project on a creek that you may not think, oh, that's a big deal. But, you know, all these projects add up to helping out so many different people. And I think it's awesome to be able to highlight these.
You know, you're right, Drew. And it is, I think, a failure of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department that oftentimes we don't highlight these projects that have been going on kind of in the background, whether it's a small little one-year project or a larger 10-year project that helps the habitat and helps everyone kind of on the ground in the landscape areas is surrounding a lot of these projects for years to come, and it helps all sorts of wildlife.
All right, John, week one, do a quick recap. Week one, we talked a little bit about some of this smaller level, the lower level projects that, you know, are needed, but maybe not as intense. And last week we talked about bank restoration and those projects that may take a little bit more time and planning and funding to get done, but obviously it's an ongoing process. And this week we're going to kind of up the game just a little more, as there are some of the projects that maybe can't be done in, you know, 1 year, or are ongoing for years and years and years. And I know that these projects are just as important or more important than something like bank restoration because of how it's going to, you know, really play a role in the future.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, some of these projects, you would call these, I suppose, the most heavy-handed approaches. And that's where we see areas of rivers and streams that have a real deficiency in giving us, you know, the benefit that we want to see. They're failing to give us the objectives that we like to see. This could be spawning habitat. This could be being able to move sediment across its channel. Maybe it's too wide to effectively move sediment out. Maybe it's too narrow and it's cutting down. But we see something that's not working, and it doesn't look like it's going to fix itself naturally in a time frame that works with what we need as a society, right? A lot of times, and folks, and it's a valid critique of this, is that a lot of times streams do heal themselves, and I see that and I acknowledge it. And however, that happens on a time frame that's outside of what a lot of us like to see. It could, you know, in some of these systems, it could be 100 years, and that's in ideal situations. Maybe 50, you know, or maybe in some situations it's quicker. However, you know, in some situations, we need to come in there and kind of usher in that succession and give these streams a hand in getting to that state they're trying to get to, that stable state. Like I said, this could be for, maybe we want to see better fish spawning. Maybe we want to see a more stable regime with sediment. But regardless, yeah, these are some of the larger projects that can take a lot more time, a lot more effort, a lot more money, but a lot of times are worth going after.
One of the topics and one of the phrases that has been used each week is fish. You know, I mean, obviously part of the Game and Fish Department, so that means that's the focus, is how do you make these fisheries sturdier? How do you make them, you know, producing more? How do you make them more appealing to people? And that's where a lot of these bigger projects, I think, really come in to play. You had mentioned if something's not working, then there's ways to change it. How do you go about figuring that part out?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to getting out on the river, out on the stream, and just taking measurements. You know, we've got pretty good data that tells us what good streams look like. And you can back that up with catching a bunch of fish. And it's a visually pretty ecosystem. I mean, think about Yellowstone, some of the rivers you see up there, you know, and up in the Absarokas or the Winds, or there's these pretty, you know, pristine environments that we have in our state. We're very lucky and blessed to have that. So we can look to those areas and the things that we observe and measure there, and we can take them to some of the areas where we have a little bit more impact on the landscape. By necessity, it's where we live, right? But we can try and bring some of those features we see. And a lot of times we'll take cues from the public. Maybe the fishing isn't as good as they'd like to see it. And a lot of times that will steer where we start fixing our attention.
So over the last 30 years or so, that's when they started doing the flushing flows. And that's when a lot of focus has been put in to create a better fishing river. So that's 30 years. And still the project is ongoing. So are there some projects that people are just now starting to think, oh, yeah, we need to start this now because in 30 years, this is going to be different?
Yeah, for sure. You brought up the flushing flows, and that was kind of one of the first major habitat alterations, fixes, strategies, you could call it, that we've implemented. And, you know, the Bureau of Reclamation has been terrific in providing those flows voluntarily for us every year. And what those do is, as many know, they clean off those gravels right before the spawn. And then that allows the fish to go and have a clean environment to put their eggs that has a lot less fine sediments in there. And trout, where trout spawn, they need that clean, cold, clear water with clean gravels. And when they have that, they can spawn. And that was one of the first undertakings that we took to and working with the BOR to try and improve the fishery here on the Platte. But since then, you know, and it, like we talked the previous week about just kind of the evolution of work, we've also been able to kind of refine what the river needs a little bit more as time has gone on. We've got, you know, some of the biologists have been here for 20 years, you know, 25 years, and they've got some real observation and things they've seen, trends they've seen over the years. And we can start to take that on the ground knowledge and apply our time and efforts in some of these bigger restoration projects. And it's been a trend that we've talked about the past, well, this is our third week here, but every week we've talked about trying to mimic what we see in nature, because a lot of times that's going to give us the most stable result. And really what these flushing flows are trying to emulate is a natural peak of flow that you would see at an undammed system. I mean, I think, you know, here in Casper, we can look to all the creeks that spill into the North Platte, you know, Deer Creek and Lavani and Box Elder, and those have their highest flows with the snowmelt. And prior to the Platte being dammed, it would have had a similar peak flow in the spring season as they would have.
It's so cool how it really all works out. Hang on, we will be back with John McCoy and Janet Millick from Wyoming Game and Fish Department talking larger, long-term habitat projects in just minutes.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Drew back on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. We're talking with John McCoy and Janet Millick about aquatic habitat projects with Wyoming Game and Fish Department. We've had 2 weeks prior to this where we've kind of built the tension. We started with the smaller projects, medium projects, and now larger projects. You can listen to those shows in the radio station's app on demand. Now, John, the idea behind the Aquatic Habitat Division of Game and Fish is to better what we have and really make better opportunities for the fish and the spawning grounds.
No, you're spot on there. We want, in the Platte specifically, to create a wild trout fishery where these fish are self-maintaining. There's minimal supplemental stocking needed. We will supplemental stock when things aren't great, but ultimately we want this population to be driven by natural recruitment, natural spawning. Where we can go in and tweak these areas, and I say tweak, we're talking about more heavy-handed stuff. The flushing flow is something, you know, was maybe more management, which is great. It gave us a great uplift. But sometimes we need to go in and reshape what the channel looks like so that it can better move those sediments out when we're doing the flushing flow. And that kind of takes us to some of the projects we're looking at in the future. Closer to Gray Reef Dam, where we've got more natural recruitment. Well, it's actually most of our natural recruitment in the Gray Reef section happened close to the dam there. And what we're doing we're looking at doing is reshaping some of those side channels to accept water longer. So throughout the year and throughout the spawning season, whereas they're currently dry some parts of the spawning season, we're looking to lower their crest elevation and have water come into those side channels at strategic times of the year to provide extra spawning habitat in those areas. And then we can go in and we can do more things to improve the spawning. You know, we've talked about clean gravels. A lot of these areas of the plat have a real lack of clean gravels because they're right beneath the dam. They've had coming up on, you know, some of these, well, it's been about a century, a little over a century of a lack of gravels washing in from upstream. So as time goes on and the river flows, those gravels kind of roll on down into the pools and out of the reach. So what we're looking at doing is coming in and adding river gravel that's an ideal size for spawning. And we're going to supplement some of these riffle areas that are maybe a little bit lacking in some of those good gravels. So between reshaping the channel to give us better flows and adding gravels, in addition to the great work that's been done with the flushing flow, we're going to be able to really improve the spawning conditions in some of these areas closer to Gray Reef.
So would that be considered creating new spawning ground, or is it enhancing what is already there?
I think it's more enhancing what's already there. But in some case, we are creating new spawning where we have side channels that, you know, say at base flow at 500 CFS, the flow we have in the winter and early spring. Currently, a lot of these areas don't see water. You know, you get mid-spring and we start to bump flows up and then they start to see water. But that first half of the spawning season is really missed out on. So where we can wet those channels earlier, we can get spawning earlier. So you are right. In those cases, we're creating something where there wasn't any spawning prior. But in addition to that, we're looking at taking what's already there and making it better.
So could you go to an area where really isn't a good spawning area or a popular spawning area and create something there, or and you know, like a spawning ground there? Or does it have to be, I mean, obviously these fish know exactly where to go, where the best conditions are, but can you mimic those conditions in other places to broaden the spawning opportunity?
Yeah, well, in channel, as we talked about last week, we're kind of constrained by the landscape around it. You have to have gradient, and gradient gives you a steeper section of river that has more oxygen and lends itself to more cleaner gravels. So these are like your ripples, your rapids, your ripples, your faster areas that are fun to go through in your canoe and kayak, right? That's where a lot of the spawning happens. So if it's a flatter portion of river, there's not much you can do there. And a lot of times when we're trying to decide where to divert valuable funds that are not unlimited, we tend to focus our efforts towards areas that have a lot of these things in place already. So gradient, riffles, that can support spawning with less input from us. Now, if we go outside the channel, there's been a lot of work that can be done in creating an artificial channel. If you can find a supplemental water source or something like that, you can create something, but that gets into a lot more technicalities with where are you getting water from, you know. But if you have the gradient, you can design something that can facilitate spawning. And it's been done in a lot of other states. There are things that we're looking at here as well, you know, in trying to just increase the natural reproduction that the fish do here.
Which, and that goes right back to at the beginning of this show, we talked how these projects are not the one year and done. These are projects that, you know, planning for something like that has been going on for years and will continue to go on for years until, you know, something comes to fruition.
Yep, and that's true. A lot of these, they take a long time to get going. And, you know, one of the other habitat biologists here in the Casper office, he's got this saying he always says, you know, these problems weren't created overnight. You know, a lot of times it's been, you know, 100 years of this cropping up and it's been gradualism, right? No one really notices it until suddenly you're like, wow, this isn't great. And so then therefore we can't expect to fix it overnight either. Sometimes we can, and that's a win. I love it when we can have a quick fix, but sometimes I think we can say, okay, it's going to take a few years to do this and do this right. And in these cases, it's that comes in with a lot more planning, a lot more funding, a lot more, you know, but just having a good plan in place to make sure we're doing this the right way and we're not just rushing into something.
You got into this job because of the love of, you know, the fish and the love of the waterways. And what is something that you would like to see starting now and just kind of gradually moving into the future, you know, projects that you'd like to really say, listen, this would be a benefit to everything on the North Platte and in our region?
Yeah, well, that kind of takes us into this, you know, this spawning enhancement that we've been poking and prodding around this morning in our conversation. But we've got a project that's kind of in its infancy stages. We're trying to get it up off the ground with funding. We've got a decent amount of planning behind it, but we're calling it the North Platte River, the Reds spawning enhancement. So this is off of the Reds area up at Gray Reef. You can access it right off the Gray Reef access road there, but it's a beautiful section of river that's got three braided sections. And currently, two of those channels in this braided section don't see flows at base flows at 500 CFS for about half of the spring. So our plan is to strategically lower the crest elevation into those side channels and give it just enough water to allow fish to start moving in and spawning earlier. And in addition to that, there's improve the habitat features in those streams so it can give us the best possible spawning habitat. Now that might be narrowing the stream to give it a little more velocity, flow, and oxygen. It might be adding supplemental gravels to give the fish more places to, you know, spawn. It might involve going to the main channel where there already is good spawning and addressing some deficiencies there as well. There's a couple of eroding banks on that stretch that contribute a few fine sediments into those, and we could look to improve those. But really, the overarching desire to do this is tied in with improving the population as a whole on the North Platte River. You know, we want to see this river sustain itself naturally and hold as many fish as we know it can. You know, it was back in 2012, we had up to 8,000 fish per river mile. I mean, that's a heck of a fishery. And I think fishermen can all remember back in those days, you had some big fish days where you were bringing a lot of fish in the boat. And the population has dwindled a little bit since then. And we've identified many reasons as to why, but habitat is one thing within my job that I can help to improve that. So yeah, yes, my pie in the sky project that I'm pushing for, that's it. That's the one. We're trying to get it off the ground. As you can imagine, this is going to take a lot of engineering because we need to make sure that while we're moving water from one channel to another, we need to make sure there's still enough water for boats to pass, you know, in the main channel so people can fish it, right? And that's where we're going to bring in these river restoration engineering firms that do this stuff, and they can model it and plan it and, you know, do it the right way. But that takes a lot of money, a lot of planning. In our case, we're bringing a lot of partners in, stakeholders from, you know, people who are interested in the resource here in Casper. And we're going to try and push this project forward here in the upcoming years.
So really, a project like this would benefit the North Platte for hundreds of years if things get rolling right along.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, that's a big number to throw out, but I like the way that sounds, you know. On into the future. You know, if we create it, you know, and it's stable, yeah, it should last. And you know, the gravels, that's something they've washed out on their own over the years. You know, if we have to come in every 25 years and supplement some gravels to these spawning areas, why that's a modest modest amount of maintenance to keep something that gives the community of Casper such great value, you know?
So let's put on our dreaming caps. you get the funding, the project starts. So you're starting the planning part, you're starting the engineers, you're starting the design. How long until the first piece of equipment would be in action?
Yeah, for this one, my prediction is, you know, from our first funder jumping on board and being able to get an engineering firm out there, I'm predicting it'll be 3 years on this one. Now, I'm optimistic. By fault, I'm an optimistic. I'm an optimist, right? I've been overly optimistic a lot, but I think it's a good way to live. It's a good way to try and live. But, you know, if we had this thing done in 5-6 years, I'd say we're doing pretty good. A little bit of background, we've already got a year, year and a half in planning behind us already too. So, you know, we're trying to get a good project here together, and it's a big undertaking. So we've got to really convince the funders that it's a worthy project that needs done. And I think we're doing that, but anytime you have a project this big, it takes some, you got to let them know there's some, you know, we've got some investment here, and we're really, this is something we're serious about and we want to do. And I think we're doing that. So like I said, this is kind of one of those things that I think needs to be done. I'm excited to work on this as a, you know, one of the bigger projects in my career. And I say, I'm just going to keep being persistent with it. And I think we're going to get it done.
Very good. Well, John, it has been a very informative last 3 weeks. I appreciate you taking the time out and letting us in a little bit on what goes in to Aquatics Habitat. Because again, I think that's, everybody sees the fish, everybody sees the elk, but you know, that's the method of the madness of how you get to that. So we appreciate it over the last couple of weeks, and now you can take a break and maybe not do as much homework.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It was great talking with you.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It has finally happened, Brian. The July is about over, and that means that we were just talking. We're only a little over a month away from the first seasons for big game coming out.
Yeah, you know, we just had the leftover draws came out this week. And so if you were unsuccessful in that first draw, or if you were successful and wanted to pick up a leftover tag, this week is the week to do that. If your area had any leftovers, they'd be available online or in the store. So, yeah, we had lots of guys coming in and hoping to pick up a few extra cow tags for their seasons. We're looking at the middle of August usually starts that first early antelope season,
which it's crazy to think it's already that time. And we have been talking for a month or so about coming in, and if you're gonna archery hunt, or if you're gonna get a new rifle and, you know, optics, like, now is the optimal time to do that.
Yeah, we've actually been extremely busy in the archery department. A lot of guys buying new bows, a lot of guys just, you know, replacing strings, upgrading their rest or their sights. Now's the time to do that, because, you know, it does take a little bit of time to get those strings ordered. And then, you know, if you are going to put some new equipment on there, you're going to want to have some time behind that bow to get some practice in.
When you're going into your archery season, I mean, obviously finding the draw strength that you want to use, and the weight, and, mm-hmm. you know, what optics you're going to use, because that's a big deal now, too, because, you know, nobody wants to just open shoot. You know?
Right. Yeah, no, there's a lot to it. You know, we don't just stock bow strings on the shelf, because that requires, you know, to know the draw length, the bow type, all that type of stuff. So they all have to be special ordered. However, you know, if you come in, we can bring your bow in. We can identify what you need. You can pick the colors out. We'll put back on. We'll get D-loop tied back on. We'll make sure your peep sights tied in, all that kind of stuff that you need to have. And, you know, even if you don't necessarily think that you need a replacement now, but you might need one at the end of the season, it's always a good idea to get one ordered, have it as a backup, so that if you do have a problem in the field, that you can get it replaced and not be out of commission for that entire archery season.
Right, because you go out, maybe you're, you know, troping through the forest, and you get your bow string caught on a boulder or a tree.
I've done it.
You drop it. Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, you know, you pull back and you dry fire it, and all of a sudden, you know, you're 2 hours, 3 hours back into the backwoods, and you're hiking it back out, going back to town, you know. So, yeah, better to be prepared than not prepared.
So we talk about the compound bows a lot, obviously, and then there's the crossbows. That, I don't know why that always throws me a loop, but the crossbows, obviously you guys carry a full line there as well. And after you shoot those so many times, you know, you start needing to do upgrades on that too.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing, especially in Wyoming, you know, we don't draw every year. And so if you do have a bow, or especially a crossbow, it's always best to make sure that you change those strings out every 200 shots or every 2 years. We've had a lot of people that, you know, hadn't drawn for a couple of years, and they go to the closet to grab their bow, and it might be in a case, and all of a sudden they open up the case and their bow is expanded, and you know, the string broke with just being under pressure for that long. So if that's the case, you know, make sure you check it. If you have any intention of using your bow this year, get that done. Generally, on the Ravens, we do carry replacement strings and cables. But on any other brand, we would have to either send them off or order them.
So my wife and I were talking. She's not an outdoor person. She hasn't ever hunted or anything like that. And, you know, I was talking about, you know, how guys will go and they'll get a new bow every year because technology changes or whatever. And she's like, well, why would you want to do that? And I was like, well, you want to give yourself the best advantage to, yeah, if you're going to spend the time and effort to go out and hike 20 miles in and, mm-hmm, and whatever, you want to have the best technology and best equipment.
Yeah, and that, you know, not only with bows, but, you know, when you're looking at optics, you know, in the field for binoculars, having rangefinders inside the binoculars is super handy. It's eliminates one extra piece of equipment. And then when you start looking at, you know, the like the Burris eliminators and the XTRs, those, you know, have some technology in them now that, you know, it has a built-in digital turret. So once you sight that in with the ballistics of the bullets that you're shooting, you know, once you know your range, all you do is, you know, turn this dial to 365 yards and pull the trigger. And so there is a lot of great technology that has helped hunters become a lot more successful in the field.
You know, you mentioned the technology for anglers. I mean, we were talking about the forward-facing sonar and all this new technology that's available, and mm-hmm, graphs are another thing where, you know, we were talking about like the 1980s when the first, you know, fishing graphs were out. It was like an old video game, and now it's, you can see the actual fish.
Yeah, you know, the days of the old flasher where you could just see the mark, you know, right below the boat and, you know, coming off the bottom a little bit is really... I mean, it's still great technology, but there's so much better out there, especially when you start looking at the forward-facing sonars. And, you know, there's a lot of different companies that have that. You know, there's Garmin, there's Lowrance, and there's Hummingbird. Those are the three what I see the most. And they've all advanced so far that, I mean, it is almost like playing a video game where you can look, you know, 100 feet ahead of you and say, oh boy, there's a fish, you know, and you can stay away from that fish. You can cast to it. You can see how the fish responds to the lure. It's pretty awesome technology. Now, is it going to definitely make you a better fisherman? Not necessarily, but it does kind of, if you are in that process or in that mindset to learn to see what those fish are doing and how they're responding to what you're throwing at them, it is pretty intriguing, and it will eventually, you know, give you some knowledge that should make you a better fisherman.
It's another tool in your toolbox, but you still have to, you know, do the work to go at it. And, you know, with doing the, you know, the fishing tournaments with you, you know, we see a lot guys carrying different types. You know, a lot of guys are doing Lowrance, a lot of guys are doing the Hummingbird. Mm-hmm. And really the technology is the same, just maybe a little tweak here or there.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got a little more different proprietary, you know, information and how their systems are working. I do think that Garmin probably is the top of the line right now. Although the new Hummingbird Live 2, probably coming in a close second. There are a lot of neat options with the Garmin. There's portable units that, you know, are completely self-enclosed, where it's got the transducer, the battery, and the screen all in one bundle. That's nice because, you know, you can take it to your buddy's boat. You can use it ice fishing. You can use it for a lot of different applications. Yeah. A little more justifiable, I guess, if you're an ice fisherman and you fish open water. But then there is just the boat-mounted, you know, sonars and transducers. That we do carry here in the store. So do some research, you know, go to YouTube, watch those videos on forward-facing sonar. Tom Bollet is a real popular YouTuber that does a lot of those videos. And if you watch him, you're going to get a really good idea of what these guys are talking about in regards to the forward-facing sonar.
So when a guy is going to put this technology in his boat, whether it's new graphs or the forward-facing sonar, does the type of boat matter as much? I know, like, if it's all in one piece, you could put that in any boat.
No, the boat option, I mean, there's guys that are using them in kayaks and, you know, that kind of stuff. But how you mount the transducer is going to be, you know, kind of dependent on the boat, whether you've got rails, whether you're going to put it into a fish rod holder, you know, type of scenario. There's guys that are just, you know, making them out there by themselves at a PVC pipe, you know. All so right. There's a lot of different options, and if you're looking at doing it, there's a ton of good information on the web about different you know, mounting brackets and that type of stuff.
Well, if you have any questions, obviously you can come in here and check them out, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And, you know, we talked a lot about the technology and the way it has advanced. But one thing that is really the same is people coming in and floating that river and getting the tubes and the rafts and, you know, just going old school down the river.
It's, you know, it's really a fun time of year. You know, we complain about the winter and how cold it is and how you're stuck inside. And, boy, if you're stuck inside this time of year, you're not trying very hard because there's a lot to do. You know, there's a lot going on downtown. But, you know, we've got the North Platte River here. And whether you're, you know, taking a fishing float trip or you're just, you know, grabbing some inner tubes or a raft and, you know, taking your buddies and going, putting it up at Robertson's and floating down to Murad Park or whatever the case is. I mean, it's kind of fun to just watch, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, you go across the bridge and it's a party, you know. Yeah. But you know, the biggest thing is just to be safe. You know, the water is the water and it could be dangerous. But for the most part, you know, if you have your life jacket with you and you're going to be just fine and you're going to have a great time.
Come on in, check them out here, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. I've been up on Casper Mountain a lot lately, and, you know, the campgrounds are full and the hiking trails are packed. So before you head up the mountain, stop in here. Hey, first off, if you're going to take your side-by-side, whatever, you got to have that ORV sticker, get your camping stickers and, you know, your day passes right here, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Drew along with Brian Woodward back at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And boy, Brian, we were just looking down through the leftover tags as they're available now. And, you know, in a lot of areas, there's not much left.
No, you know, the popularity of especially some of the areas that are close, 19 and 7, I don't think a guy has a chance to even pick up anything on a leftover draw.
Right.
I think, you know, those pretty much get all sucked up on that first initial draw. So, but there are some areas available, and, you know, best thing to do is get online, use their hunt planner, look at the areas that have tags available, see if the area that you're familiar with at all. We know that a lot of these areas that do have leftover tags have pretty difficult access, you know, so there's a lot of private. You can identify that, you know, with the Onyx maps, or you can come in and buy a BLM map, and that'll give you a lot of that information as well. But yeah, I mean, do your due diligence. You know, when you come into us or go into the Game and Fish and you say, yeah, I want a tag for 33. Is there any good elk in that area? Or, I mean, like, yeah, you know, we're not going to be able to give you that kind of information, you know, and, you know, we're not going to be able to tell you what the access is. You're going to have to do some of your own homework. And, you know, if you want to roll the dice and buy the tag and then go knock on landowners' doors, that's one option. But we certainly don't have that information.
Right. And that's difficult. We've known guys over the last couple of years that have done that thinking that they had an in, but then that door closes and they just eat that tag. So knowing exactly, you know, where to hunt, and with the Access Yes program, that is always a good thing with Game and Fish to, you know, get that hunt planner and really, you know, check it out. So, you know, Brian, what I was thinking over the last couple of weeks is, you know, we've been doing a lot of fishing and about to transition over into that hunting. And this year I'd like to have that rifle that, you know, I can use every year over and over and over. And, you know, the last couple of years I've been going with Tony and used Tony's gun. That
right.
It's sighted in and, you know, it's rock solid.
Right.
But when you're coming in and I don't have the budget that he does, you know, what are some good options for guys that maybe you're looking for that? Because we talked antelope in just a little over a month. So right. You got to come in and get that sighted in and ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, we carry like three of the major brands, and we have access to some others, but, you know, we've been really solid with Burris, Vortex, and Leopold. You know, there's great options in all of them. They're all starting to come out with some CDS systems, or that custom dial systems, where you can customize your rifle to the specs of your ammunition that you're shooting. That's a neat option. There's a lot of digital options now with Burris's PH, where once you sight it in, you just turn the turret on the top to the actual distance that you want to shoot and put straight crosshairs on them. All three of those manufacturers have lifetime warranties on them. We see very little returns from Leopold and Burris, not so much on the other, but there's a lot of great options. And price-wise, you know, especially on optics, I tell everybody, you do get what you pay for. So in terms of quality of glass, the clarity of glass, you know, if you're going to spend $99 on a scope, you're going to get a level that maybe is not going to be as good as a $1,000 scope. Right. But there's a lot of levels in between. So normally when I'm talking to somebody, you know, and they're looking at scopes, I ask them, well, what are you trying to scope up? What kind of a rifle? You know, is it a 30-06? Is it a 6mm? Is it a long range type of gun? Are you looking for something with a real complicated reticle? So you have, you know, more a Christmas tree reticle where you have more windage and holdover lines? Or are you just looking for just a straight hunting rifle with a BDC reticle? So I kind of start there, ask them if they're brand specific, ask them what their price range is, kind of give them a recommendation on asking them how far that they think they're going to be able to or want to shoot. And that'll kind of determine what kind of magnification we're going to be looking at scope-wise for a recommendation.
So a guy spends $1,000 on a quality, top-of-the-line Leopold mm-hmm. scope.
Right.
Does the gun he puts it on matter as much with, you know, that much accuracy in that scope?
No, I mean, as long as we get it, you know, mounted properly, we get it leveled, we get it bore sighted, you're going to be able to get on paper at the range pretty easily. And then from there, it's just going to be practice behind it. If you're going to deal with the custom dial system with like Leopold, you're going to want to, you know, really chronograph that ammunition, really get as good a ballistic information as you possibly can. And, you know, and how it shoots here at 5,000 feet might be different than how it shoots at 8,000 feet. So, you know, there are some different options with scopes that give you turret options with, you know, two different elevation levels. So that there are some things out there that a guy can do. For the most part, you know, most of our guys are going to be shooting at that, you know, 5,000 to 8,000 foot. You're probably not going to get that much of a variance on how that thing is shooting, in terms of, you might be off a half inch or maybe a quarter inch, or I don't know, but it just depends. So I would just kind of pick a elevation that you think that you're going to do most of your hunting at, and then get everything sighted in at that level.
And the way that the guns have changed over the years, I mean, my grandpa gave me a 12 gauge that was from the 1970s, mm-hmm. and that sucker is heavy.
Right.
Now, you know, it changes. If you're going to hike in somewhere, you don't want to lug a, you know, 15 pound rifle on your back. And if you have good quality, you know, a scope or whatever, mm-hmm. you want to have a gun you can shoot.
I mean, we're seeing, you know, just a lot of factory guns that are, you know, almost semi-custom at this point. Weatherby's coming out with some great stuff. Bergara's coming out with some great stuff. Fierce has some really great rifles. And we're talking those rifles are getting down to that 5 or 6 pound range. You know, I think back in the day, you know, grandpa handed you a gun, the gun alone was 10 or 12 pounds. Yeah. So they're cutting the weight immensely on those. Scopes, you know, are probably going to be anywhere from, you know, let's just say an average of a pound, depending on what you go with. So you can, you know, if you put a bipod on it and you put, you know, whatever else, I mean, you can keep adding to the weight. But it also kind of depends on the type of hunting that you're going to be doing, you know. I mean, very few of us are walking back in 10 or 12 miles into a hunting location.
Yeah, right.
And as I get older, the closer to the road I can shoot it, the better off I am.
When you get a gun that is that much lighter, I mean, we're talking 7 pounds lighter sometimes, are you getting higher recoil now, or does the technology of the guns manufacturing work into play there?
Oh, I think technology has really helped with the recoil reduction on a lot of those. And it depends on the load as well, right? I mean, you can shoot a 250 grain bullet or a 95 grain bullet. I mean, that's gonna make a big difference on recoil. You don't have that many choices in some calibers, and a lot of people have different theories on that. Some, you know, try to get the highest grain possible, and other ones are looking for the fastest bullet possible. So, and every gun shoots something a little bit differently. So if you are looking, especially if you've kind of thought that, you know, well, I've always shot, you know, nozzle or AccuBonds and this load and this load. If you don't have that ammo stockpiled at your house, come to the store and see if that ammo is available. Because since COVID, there's been a lot of changes with those manufacturers. Bullets haven't been available. Powder hasn't been available. Primers have been tough. And so that's changed their loads quite a bit. So that load that you may have been buying for the last 30 years may not even be available. So you may have to step down or step into a different type of a load, whether it's a different manufacturer or just a whole different load in general. They're probably going to be a different bullet than what you've been shooting. If that's the case, you know, you're going to need to grab a box, see how your rifle shoots it, and then maybe start the sight-in process all over again.
Yeah, so I'll tell you that now is a great time to do this. We talked about that where, you know, antelope's coming up, but if you weren't one of the lucky ones, you may still have a couple of months before you get out into the field. Come in. We've even got the layaway program here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. So if you want that new rifle, you want the new optics, you know, want the shells, now's a good time to come in and drop it in layaway.
Yeah, and as far as optics goes, if you're thinking about replacing your scope, you know, bring your firearm into the store. You know, we can see what you're mounting. We can give you a recommendation on bases, on rings. We can give you a recommendation on scopes. When you purchase any of those pieces or parts here, we're going to mount that and bore sight it for you for free. So as I kind of joke with people, you know, putting a scope on can be like a really bad plumbing project. I know everybody likes to do it at home. I've got this workbench set up, and you know, but then, you know, you try this base and, oh, that was a long action, not a short action. Oh, this is a 20 MOA, not a zero MOA. You know, you tend to go back and forth quite a bit. If you bring it in here, we can do all the dirty work for you, and get you the right parts and pieces.
So keep you one trip in Rocky Mountain Discount Sports instead of a dozen.
That's right.
Come on in, check them out, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports or RockyMountainSports.com, or go over and follow them, Rocky Mountain Sports Casper on Facebook. That's going to do it for another episode of Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you can go to the radio station's app on demand and listen 24/7 to all of our episodes.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.